The book of Genesis is a book of beginnings, genealogies. If you remember the word, it's toledoths, toledoths. And what a toledoth is, it's a genealogy. It's basically talking about this is the generation of. It's the first book in the Bible, and it reveals to us the beginning, where we came from, our relationship to the eternal creator who created us. We've seen so far in our study of Genesis how God created the world out of nothing, nothing but his word. Into this world, he brought life to the oceans, to the skies, to the land. And then in his own likeness, he made mankind. He made a people for himself, a people that he loved. And he prepared a beautiful, fruitful, perfect place for them to live and thrive. And they enjoyed his presence there. But sin entered the garden, and mankind, through Adam's sin, fell. Death and separation from God would now be the sentence for every person who would be born from that point forward. Sinners by nature and sinners in practice, each one condemned, but God. You're going to come to love as you delve into God's word, you're going to love those two words, but God. In his perfect plan of love and grace, promised that there would come a seed from the woman who would crush the serpent's head. God had already planned to save his people, the object of his love, out of the corrupted and condemned human race. So the question that we have right at the beginning is, so who are God's people? Who are the people that he loves? The book of Genesis provides the toledoth, the generation of Adam. And in that toledoth, we read of his offspring. And first we read of Cain and Abel. Abel worshiped God with his whole heart. But Cain gave what he wanted to. And it wasn't accepted by God. And so right off the bat, in this very first family, in this very first toledoth of the human race, we find that Adam and Eve had two sons. And you see that there's a difference in these two. One of them heard God, and this is what he wanted for worship, and he obeyed it and gave God, acknowledged God, obeyed God, and believed God. One said, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. I'm going to do it my way, and if he doesn't accept it, oh well. And God said, I'm not going to accept it. And God told him, just do the right thing. But he didn't. Murdered his brother. And so we have the first murder. And so right off the bat, you see these first two people. Then God brought Seth into this family. And we watch then Seth and Cain. We find that Seth is one of God's own, one of those that he loves. And this line, and we start to follow this line. There's this expectation that this serpent crusher is coming. And so even, I'm sure Adam and Eve wondered with each son, is it this one? Is it this one? There's an expectation that one is coming who would crush the serpent's head. And so we start to follow that it's in Seth's line. It's a line that would lead to not only the serpent crusher, but the one we know as the Christ. But before we leave Adam's toledoth, we're told of what happens to Cain, right? We've got a genealogy of Cain, and we kind of watch as they're peeled off and they go into the world. And then that moves us then into the next toledoth. And so by the time we get to Noah's toledoth, the population has greatly increased, as well as wickedness and sin, so that now only Noah still walks before the Lord, this remnant of one, blameless amongst his generation. God brings the flood, keeping Noah and his family safe through the judgment in his ark. And at the end of his toledoth, we follow his sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And what do we have at the end of that toledoth? A genealogy. We're told what happens with those sons. We follow Seth's line, which leads to that promised serpent crusher. But then now we begin to see in Noah's offspring, not just the line to Christ from Seth and Adam, but again we see two different groups of people. There are those who walk before the Lord and acknowledge him, and then there are those who do not. And so we see the offspring of Noah spread out across the earth. And we read through each genealogy. Which then moves us forward into the next toledoth in chapter 12, where we We come to the Toledoth of Abraham, and God calls him out of the pagan world of idolatry to a land that God has appointed for him. It's a land that God would prepare for his people, and his people would come from and through Abraham. What you start to see as we're going through Genesis is that God is revealing more and more of his plan. And things get a little bit more specific. And so in the beginning, we see these two people groups. But as it goes forward, we start to get identifiers. We start to see character traits. We start to see the difference between these two. We watch in this Toledoth as Abraham is brought out of that pagan world, out of that group of people that we would consider to be kind of the other people. But when God calls to him, he hears. And he believes God. Puts his faith and trust in God. And what does God say? He accounts that for righteousness. You're the one, you're mine. We start to realize, wow, he's pulled him into this people group who bow the knee before him. And so he trusts God by faith. Faith that he's God. Faith that he can trust in the promises. And he follows God where he leads. And then God makes a promise to him. Not just that the sin crusher would come, but he makes a covenant with him and he gives him, he says, this land, I'm going to give you this land, all of this land. We watch through the Bible as that land goes from a small piece of land to the heavens and the earth. I'll give you fruitful children. You're going to have lots of offspring, so numerous that you're not going to be able to count them. And from them, there's going to be nations. And in those nations, there's going to be kings. We know that there's going to be a king of kings that's going to come. And so we start to see that there's this inference, there's this promise that's leading that, God, you can trust me. Everything I've told you is going to come to pass. Not only all those things, but he says, in you, every family on the earth will be blessed. It's a serpent crusher, right? That serpent crusher that's going to come, that serpent crusher who's going to crush death is going to be a blessing for every family. You know what that tells you? It tells you that there are those of each side of those people in every family. Those of his in everyone. Every nation of the earth. But it also tells us that there's two sets. And with each transition, we're provided more detail, more revelation. God's call, God's promise, God's covenant of land, nation, kings, offspring, blessing. And we see that this blessing will be for every family. And so we start to see these two peoples now with a little bit more identifying marks. God's people, what do we know so far if we're about chapter 15 in Genesis? They walk before God, which means they walk in a way that they follow his lead. They obey his command. They acknowledge him as their God. They worship him. They acknowledge him. They have faith in him. They trust in his promises. But we start to see on the other side, these others, they walk their own way. They mock him and his plan. They trust in themselves. They resent God and his people. We start to see that especially as we get into Ishmael and Isaac. We move from Abraham's Toledoth. And what do we find at the end of Abraham's Toledoth? Ishmael's genealogy. And then now we're following to Isaac's Toledoth. And in Isaac's Toledoth, one of the things that's interesting when you understand how God explains the life of these folks, what do we often see? With Adam and Eve, what would we learn about? Cain and Abel and Seth. With Noah, how do we learn about Noah? It's his family. It's Ham and Shem and Japheth. Abraham, how do we learn about Abraham? We start to see what he does with Isaac and with Ishmael. And so when we follow Isaac, who do you think the story is going to revolve around? It's going to be Jacob and Esau. We quickly learn there's a struggle going on inside of the belly of Isaac's wife. The struggle going on, right? And we quickly learn that Jacob is one of his. We already know he's one of his. He's one of the Spirit. He's one of God's children. He's one that's loved by God. And in that same womb is another. Part of that other people, one of those of the flesh. That's different. And what's interesting about this struggle, it takes place in the womb. I want you to understand that there's a picture that's starting to develop. This struggle happens from the very beginning to the very end. That struggle goes on. Make more sense as we go along. We find out that Jacob's going to be the one appointed to carry the line of blessing. We're introduced to this struggle. Two nations, we're told, two peoples, we're told, are inside, and their struggle is real. But the good news is one of them's going to prevail. The younger will prevail over the older. The weaker will prevail over the stronger. Why? Because God has his hand on that one. This section, we see the glaring issue of the heart that greatly displeases the Lord in Esau. It's not really an answer as to why one was picked and one wasn't, but it does give us an inkling into the heart that God saw in Esau that really made him, in the Bible it says, hate him. His birthright. His birthright represented the blessing of God, the promise of God, God's intervention, God's leading of their family, the value of God's promise and covenant with his people, the privilege of being one of God's own. All of those things are represented in this birthright. It meant to be loved by God. I'm loved by God. What do we know about Esau? He despised it. He thought very little of it. Who cares about God's promises? Who cares about being one of God's people? Who cares about his love? I don't get it, right? This isn't me. He thought so little of it that he was really hungry one day after a hunting trip. And he came in and his brother said, well, I will give you this bowl of soup, stew, if you will give me your birthright. He goes, I don't care. What good is a birthright to me? He traded this privilege of being in God's blessing, being one of God's own, for a bowl of stew, because he was hungry. This is in front of me right now. I can eat it right now. I can have it right now. You can have God. I'll take the stew. That's a heart that God hates. Again, we start to get more info on the people who are not the Lord's. They could care less about his love and promises. They want what they want, and they want it now. There's no faith in promises. There's no delay. I want it now. And then we follow Jacob to Laban's house through two marriages, an escape from Laban, 12 children, a peaceful return home, a mess of a family, a wrestling match with God. And then we see God call him, and he calls him by name, and he gives him a name in which his people are going to be known. They're going to be identified with him, Israel. They would become the people of Israel. And God would be their God, and he would give them the land, the nations, the blessing, and the one to come. But we're about to leave the Toledoth of Isaac and move into the Toledoth of Jacob. And so you should be expecting, before we leave, what do we have to do? We got to get rid of Esau. We've got to see what happened to Esau. And the Lord gives one full chapter to what happens to Esau. The other people. So we're going to have Esau's genealogy, but I want you to think about something. If Israel is going to be the name that the people of God would be identified with, what about Esau's people? How will we know them? How will we identify them? What are they going to be identified with? Will Esau's name change? Open up your Bibles to chapter 36. Esau's genealogy. Think of them as the other people. There's God's people, and then there's the other people. Do you remember when Isaac breathed his last week? What happened? He was gathered to his people. His people, those people of faith. Well, today we're going to learn a little bit about the other group. I'm going to read through it. I'm going to try not to go fast. My wife says I always go fast when I want to get through something, but I want to make sure that we read every single word, and then we'll break it out, and I won't do it verse by verse, so don't worry. These are the generations of Esau, that is Edom. Esau took his wives from the Canaanites, Ada, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, Oholibamah, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibeon the Hivite, and Basemath, Ishmael's daughter, the sister of Nebaioth. And Ada bore to Esau Eliphaz, Basemath bore Reuel, and Oholibamah bore Jeush, Jalam, and Korah. These are the sons of Esau who were born to him in the land of Canaan. Then Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all the members of his household, his livestock, all his beasts, and all his property that he had acquired in the land of Canaan. He went into a land far away from his brother Jacob. For their possessions were too great for them to dwell together. The land of their sojournings could not support them because of their livestock. So Esau settled in the hill country of Seir. Esau is Edom. These are the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites in the hill country of Seir. These are the names of Esau's sons: Eliphaz, the son of Ada, the wife of Esau; Reuel, the son of Basemath, the wife of Esau. The sons of Eliphaz were Timon, Omar, Zepho, Gotam, and Kenaz. Timnah was a concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son. She bore Amalek to Eliphaz. These are the sons of Ada, Esau's wife. These are the sons of Reuel: Nahath, Zerah, Shammah, and Mizzah. These are the sons of Basemath, Esau's wife. These are the sons of Oholibamah, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibeon, Esau's wife. She bore to Esau Jeush, Jalam, and Korah. Now it shifts. These are the chiefs of the sons of Esau. The sons of Eliphaz, the firstborn of Esau, the chiefs: Temon, Omar, Zepho, Kenaz, Korah, Gitam, and Amalek. These are the chiefs of Eliphaz in the land of Edom. These are the sons of Ada. These are the sons of Reuel, Esau's son, the chiefs: Nahath, Zerah, Shammah, and Mizzah. These are the chiefs of Reuel in the land of Edom. These are the sons of Basemath, Esau's wife. These are the sons of Oholibamah, Esau's wife, the chiefs: Jeush, Jalam, and Korah. These are the chiefs born of Oholibamah, the daughter of Anah, Esau's wife. These are the sons of Esau, that is Edom, and these are their chiefs. Now he comes in. These are the sons of Seir, the Horite. He's going to talk out of his family and talk about the people in the land where they're joining with, the families of the wives. The Horite, the inhabitants of the land: Lotan, Shobal, Zibeon, and Anna, Dishon, Ezer, and Dishon. These are the chiefs of the Horites, the sons of Seir in the land of Edom. The sons of Lotan were Hori and Hemam, and Lotan's sister was Timnah. Remember her? She's the concubine. These are the sons of Shobal: Alvan, Manahath, Abel, Shepho, and Onam. These are the sons of Zibeon: Aiah and Anna. He is the Anna who found the hot springs in the wilderness as he pastured the donkeys of Zibeon, his father. Let's talk about that. These are the children of Anah: Dishon and Oholibamah, the daughter of Anah. These are the sons of Dishon: Hemdan, Eshban, Ephran, and Charan. These are the sons of Ezer: Bilhan, Zavon, and Akan. These are the sons of Dishon: Uz, and Aran. These are the chiefs of the Horites, the chiefs: Lotan, Shobal, Zibeon, Anah, Dishon, Ezer, and Dishon. These are the chiefs of the Horites, chief by chief in the land of Seir. Then he goes on to the kings that came into the land. These are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the Israelites. Bela, the son of Beor, reigned in Edom, the name of his city being Dinhabah. Bela died, and Jobab, the son of Zerah of Bozrah, reigned in his place. Jobab died, and Husham of the land of the Temanites reigned in his place. Husham died, and Hadad, the son of Bedad, who defeated Midian in the country of Moab, reigned in his place, the name of his city being Avith. Hadad died, and Samla of Masrekah reigned in his place. Samla died, and Shaul of Rehoboth on the Euphrates reigned in his place. Shaul died, and Baal-Hanan, the son of Achbor, reigned in his place. Baal-Hanan, the son of Achbor, died, and Hadar reigned in his place, and the name of his city being Pau. His wife's name was Mehetabel, the daughter of Matred, daughter of Mehzahab. These are the names of the chiefs of Esau, according to their clans and their dwelling places. These are the guys who founded cities that became kind of rulers in the regions. According to their clans and their dwelling places, by their names, the chiefs: Timnah, Alva, Jetheth, Oholibamah, Ela, Pinan, Kenaz, Timan, Mibzar, Magdiel, and Aram. These are the chiefs of Edom, that is Esau, the father of Edom, according to their dwelling places in the land of their possession. First off, nine times something is repeated that obviously God wants you to hear. Esau, who is Edom, nine times. Jacob becomes Israel. Esau becomes Edom. Esau, the name of it, meant hairy. Remember he was born? He was hairy, kind of furry. Edom in Hebrew is related to Adam. The same roots are involved, Edom and Adam. Do you remember what Adam's name meant? Red dirt. Remember? Red earth. It was to point to the fact that God had created him out of the earth. And so when he looked at him, Adam, red dirt. Edom is connecting, God's connecting Edom to Adam in the red. It simply means red. But the inference is, you're the red dirt, you're the flesh. Red flesh starts to make you understand then why through the scriptures, Edom, when you start to see Edom, represents the flesh. And it's always at war with the spirit, Edom against Israel, Esau against Jacob. That's how it starts to build. The Edomites, the people of Edom, the other people who are not his, they're identified with this red flesh. And the struggle is always there between those of faith and those of flesh. Do you know that we, on this side, we have relatives from both of those lines, and so guess what? Each of you has this battle raging inside, yes? This battle between flesh and spirit. Romans 9, and if you look at 7, 8, and 9, you start to see what Paul's doing there. The chapter is explaining the extent of God's sovereign choices. Paul's argument, though, when he's pointing to God's choosing, do you remember who he uses? He uses Jacob and Esau as his illustration. He wants to point out who are what? Who are truly the Lord's and who truly aren't. And right before he does that, look at what he says in verse 8. It is not the children of the flesh who are the children of God. It's the children of promise who are the children of God. Two groups. Do you see them there? Children of flesh. Children of promise, children of the Spirit, children of God. They're ones who trust in his promise. Paul then in verse 11 points to the twins before being born, and God had chosen the older will serve the younger. Jacob I have loved, Esau I have hated. Jacob, the child of God, Esau, the child of flesh. That good? Settled in your mind? You kind of get this understanding that there is this battle between these two. And so then as you read through Scripture, you're going to come to find that this struggle between Jacob and Esau, Israel and Edom, that began even in the womb, is a picture of the struggle that people of faith will have with people of the flesh from beginning to end, till Christ returns. The offspring of Esau, the Edomites, Israel today calls them still the most significant enemy of Israel throughout the Bible and throughout history, even until Christ returns. And if we take that picture to heart, we see this fight against our flesh. We sometimes don't think hard enough about the fact that we're in a constant battle. Great struggle. But in the midst of that struggle, one of the things that you need to take is that verse that says, greater is he that is in me than he that is in the world. We know that the weaker prevails. So, I want to take a second and look into this genealogy so that we can move forward and get to Joseph. Knowing what Esau represents, I want you to see that there are some identifiers of the flesh and these people that are driven by the flesh. First off, verse 2, Esau takes his wives from where? The Canaanites. Right off the bat. Do you remember back in chapter 27, Rebekah makes it very clearly known. She doesn't want her sons marrying any girls of the land. That's how it's translated. Hittite women. Remember she says, I just loathe myself because of those Hittite wives of Esau. You know what it means? These local pagan girls. They knew that they were not to go and marry these local pagan girls. And we're told that she loathed her life because of them. Turn back just to Genesis 28 for 1 second. I want you to hear what Esau heard. Esau overhears Jacob blessing, or Isaac blessing Jacob in chapter 28. Verse 6. Listen to what he says. Now Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Paddan Aram to take a wife from there, and that as he blessed him, he directed him. And listen to what he heard. You must not take a wife from the Canaanite women. And Jacob had obeyed his father and his mother and gone to Paddan Aram. So when Esau saw that the Canaanite women did not please Isaac, his father, well, you know how that story goes. Any of you that have had kids. I want you to see something about the flesh. When you're told you can't have something, that seems to be the one thing that you want most. Every time that happens to you, understand that's the flesh. That's the flesh that's speaking to you. It takes us all the way back to the garden, doesn't it? You can have everything in here except one. Satan comes and says, why not this one? You're right. It does look beautiful and it does look good to eat. You see that same idea the minute that that's the one we want. Anyway, so you see that going on. Rebellious, resentful, unconcerned about what is right. He's concerned about what he wants. And if I tick off my parents in the process, all the better, because I resent them, I hate my brother, and this will make everybody miserable for a long time. Ada is his first wife. She's daughter of Elon the Hittite. Her name means a desirable ornament, like booty. Not that kind of booty. It's like pirate's booty. Right? That's what he was looking at. It's something that catches the eye of a thief. So it's like a bauble of sorts. And it's like, oh, so it just puts something that shades it. You know, there's only two Adas in the Bible, two women named Ada in the entire Bible. Both of them early in Genesis. Do you know who the first one was? If you remember back in Genesis 4, Cain's great-great-great-grandson Lamech, remember him? He's the one that said, Cain was able to murder, his rage was murderous and seven times. Mine's 70 times that seven times. I'm 70 times more ruthless and mean and nasty than my great-great-great-grandfather Cain. And we're told in Genesis 4, only second woman named in the Bible, that he married Ada. And so Esau marries another Ada. Only two of them, both of them marry men of the flesh. But we find out later that Ada's father, Elon, was a very powerful man in the region. He was very political, had a lot of power down in Seir. Oholibamah, she's the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibeon, the Hivite. Her name is interesting. Her name means tent of the high places. What do you know about the high places when you read the Old Testament? What's up in the high places? Idol worship and spots, right? That's where everybody went to go worship their idols, up in the high places. So the tent that's next to those idol worship and spots is what? Where the priestesses would live. What did the priestesses do to woo men to come and worship the idol? Lots of ugly stuff. That's her name. It made me think for a second when he walks into the door and says, Mom, Dad, I'd like to introduce to you Ada and 10 of prostitutes. Not only are they local pagan girls, they're named well. It's taught that Oholibamah was from a pagan priestly family. But we're also told in this chapter that her brother was Anah. Anah was famous down in Seir. You know what he was famous for? He found wells, hidden wells of water. Now for us, we're like, okay, that's cool. Back then, hidden wells of water meant that up there in the hill country where they're at, they're going to be able to prosper. This was wealth for the entire country. This was something that was going to be really exciting. And so he was exceptionally famous and beloved for finding these wells. She was his brother. You start to see he marries into political rulership, He then has someone who's famous into his famous family. You start to see something developing here. Then we come to Basemath. She means spicy smelling. She smelled like spice. She's from Ishmael's house. What do we know about Ishmael? One, it's a wealthy family. She comes from great wealth. Ishmael did very well. And they're very anti-Israel. They're very much an anti-Isaac family, if you can imagine. And so do you think that if he married her when he goes down to Seir, that anti-Isaac would go a long way? You start to understand he's postured himself very well with these three wives. Not only did he get to upset his parents, it looks like it's going to work out for him. So while he still lived in the land, still in that land of promise, near to his mom and dad, he had five sons while he was there: Eliphaz, Reuel, Jeash, Jalem, and Korah. And then Esau and his family and his holdings They need to make a move. And you need to understand, his wealth was substantial. The way it's worded in there is that it was substantial wealth. He had servants, livestock, tons of material property, possessions. And so he moves to the land southeast of the promised land. Why did he move? He's in the land that's been promised to his people. But he's going to move out of the land of promise. Why? Because Jacob's there. And with all of Jacob's wealth and with all of his wealth, it was all he was going to get. There was no room to grow. There was nothing more to conquer, nothing more to take, nothing more to build. And so he leaves this land of promise in order to do what? Get more wealthy, get more powerful, get what he wants. So he moves his whole family out. Their possessions were too great to stay there with Jacob. Another identifier for people of the flesh, never satisfied, always wanting more, discontent, willing to move away from God's blessing in order to get more. Boy, you could take that and just meditate on that this week. I've seen so many people that will take a promotion that ruins a family. Make a move that just hinders their walk. If you're in the middle of God's will, God's blessing, stay there till he calls you to somewhere else. Wait for his pull. Don't get ahead of him. Esau settles in the hill country of Seir. Again, we're told Esau is Edom. You can imagine Moses is writing this to the Israelites. Now, the Israelites, as they're coming out of the captivity down in Egypt, they cross the Red Sea, they come in, and as they're resting, they get hit by the Amalekites. Soon after, they're not able to cross the land of the Edomites. And you can imagine all of these people, this is 400 years later, going, why do these people hate us so much? What's wrong with these people? Moses is writing this to them to say, this is why they're so hateful. You need to know who they are. This is Edom. This is the people of Seir. This is, you know, where these folks come from. And the genealogy ensues from Eliphaz. We move forward. His first son, Eliphaz, takes a concubine. Her name is Timna. And the way that it's worded, it sounds like he took her out of wedlock. Sounds like they got together and decided to make a son. She's a concubine, not a wife. Their son's name is Amalek. Does that ring a bell? Should. She was a daughter of one of the most powerful families there. And so what the Bible tells us is that she was a sheik. It's very rare that a woman would be called a sheik or a duke, right? She's a sheik. She's got status. She's royal family. She came into this family of Esau with a purpose of uniting her power to Esau's wealth and drive. Their son Amalek is considered to be the greatest enemy of Israel still today. Israelites will talk of Hitler as an Amalekite. They call him Amalekian. He's just like an Amalek. Hates the people. And you can still see in the world that spirit of the Amalekite thinking of we just want to see them gone, dead, put away with. They're the people that God loves. Duh. Let's kill them all. This people of his possession. Let's get rid of them. Then we're all on equal footing. Anyway, Israel, what you start to realize with Amalek, they just get away from Pharaoh's army. They see the Red Sea and they get to Rephidim. And in Rephidim, they're thirsty. Break open a rock. There's water. They're hungry. We've got the manna. So they're kind of settling in saying, okay, this stuff tastes kind of bland, but we're okay. And all of a sudden, they get hit by Amalek's army. Amalek, the Amalekites, are the first ones to go after them. For time, I won't go into that verse today, but basically understand, they come in. That's the picture, if you go to it this week, where Moses is raising his hand in the battle, and every time he gets tired, they start to lose in the hands. And so you can go and find that. It's in Exodus 17. Generational war has begun. God hates Amalek. He hates Esau, the Edomites. There is this hatred of this whole line, this whole way of thinking, this whole people group. And so when they come into the land, Deuteronomy 25, when they're being warned about all these things, they're given the reminder in Deuteronomy 17:19, don't forget about the Amalekites. You got to get rid of the Amalekites. All of them. They need to be removed. Much later, in 1 Samuel, remember Israel wants their own king, an earthly king. And isn't it interesting, did you notice in here that Esau had kings probably 200 years earlier than Israel. He got what he wanted now. They wanted a king. And so they get Saul. Saul is told by the Lord, all right, take out the Amalekites. Take out every single Amalekite. Don't touch any of their goods. Every bit of the Amalekites have to go. What's interesting is when you look at the Amalekites, there's a picture, another illustration of sin. So you have sin in the midst of flesh. And so when we were going through 1 Samuel with the youth group, I loved this section because what it talks about is if sin is in your life, you got to get rid of all of it. You don't leave any of it alive. You've got to get rid of any of it because if there's any little bit left, it'll come back and get you. God told him, kill it all. Don't take an animal. Don't take anything. Destroy it. So Saul destroys most of it. If you remember the story, most of it. And then God calls Samuel and says, go tell Saul I'm done. Done with him. He didn't do as I asked. Samuel's angry. He goes over to Saul. And as he's walking up to Saul, he hears something. What does he hear? Sheep bleeding. Cows. They look like cows and sheep. My favorite, when our youth group, when we went through it, this is a relic. Some of the guys that are in here still have this shirt, but what is the bleeding of the sheep that I hear? Right? That was our motto for our youth group for a long time. We got to get rid of all of our sin. If you leave any little bit, it's going to come back and get you. Saul comes running out to meet Samuel. I did it. I killed them all. And Samuel's my favorite. Well, then what is the bleeding of the sheep that I hear? Well, and then you hear the justification, the rationalization. Well, we kept all of the best so that we can put them as an offering to God, so that we can do this for God. Yeah, that's it. And isn't Agag still alive? Yes, Agag the king is still alive. Why did you keep him? God had told you to get rid of all of it. So what does Samuel have to do? He takes King Agag and takes him down and hacks him to pieces. It's a great story. What we didn't realize, though, is that somewhere between that time, Agag had gotten out and sired another child. And so the Amalekites lived on. Do you know the next time they pop up? The book of Esther. If you read it, you're going to find out that Haman, the one who wants to do what? Kill all of the Jews, is an Agagite, which makes him an Edomite. Kind of interesting as you follow these things through, and when you leave sin to itself, this is what happens. So the rest of this chapter of 36, it gets a little messy. It's hard to, verse by verse, without charts and graphs, to walk it out for you. So I'm just going to very quickly run through it. Esau's got 5 sons with 4 women. With Ada, he's got Eliphaz. With Aholibamah, he's got Jeash, Jalam, and Korah. And with Bashemath, he has Reuel. He's got grandsons, and from Eliphaz, you got Teman, Gadam, Omar, Zepho, Kenaz, and then the worst, Amalek. From Reuel, he gets Nathan, Zerah, Shammah, and Mizza. And when you get all of those together, you get his 12, his kingdom of 12. You're going to find that Jacob's going to have 12 princes. These are his 12 princes. And you're like, well, there's 13 when you count them. There's the 12, and then there's Amalek. Amalek kind of stands out on his own, and what you find is Amalek becomes, the Amalekites are identified with Amalek because he rises to be such a high level. Then you start to see that we're going to be introduced to Esau's family. Digging in a bit, you find that Esau married for power, fame, control, and through these matches, they brought together their wealth, all of the power, their status, their holdings, and what do? They establish a dynasty. Seir. When you go through the Old Testament and God refers to Mount Seir or Seir, he's always talking about the region. When he wants to talk about the people, he calls them Edom. People of the flesh, Edomites. Then moves to the kings of Edom in this chapter. The kings, and Moses says, long before Israel had a king, we're not even into the judges yet with these folks, and they've already got kings. And he goes through all of the kings and their family. One died, the next one comes. And then finally, out of all of that come the sheiks. The sheiks who have much property, the ones who establish cities and regions. And that's how the chapter ends. It's a worldly place. It's a place where all of the folks are striving, building, fighting. And so as the people of Israel leave Egypt 400 years after this time, they're escaping Egypt. Edomites attack them. They're the very first people to attack them when they get close to the land for no reason. Well, they would say they have a reason. When they seek to cross the Edomite region, they're asking permission decades later. They said, we just want to get to the land. We won't let any of our animals eat any of the food. We won't let them drink any of the water. And what are they told by the Edomites? Step foot on our land and you will die. Throughout the entire history of Israel and the land, the only times of peace with Edom was when they were having a truce. And you know why they had a truce? Because someone meaner and bigger than Edom was after Edom, and Edom needed an ally. They would run to Israel, and Israel would always take them in and would ally with them till the big guy was gone. Once he was gone, then they went back to their war. Then you come to the point where they do something that you can tell in God's vernacular, done. You are going to be stubble. There will be nothing left of your land. There will be nothing left of your people. The end. And you have a lot of the different, Isaiah speaks of it, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Malachi, Obadiah, the entire book of Obadiah is dedicated to God's disgust and destruction of Edom. You know what they did? When the Babylonians were coming in to sack Jerusalem and Israel, they would come in and pillage and steal from all of the Israelites who were under siege. They would take their wealth, take their stuff. When they would try and escape on the roads, the Edomites would stay at the crossroads and point out and hand over all of the Israelites to the Babylonians to be murdered, killed. Not only that, says that when Jerusalem was being sacked and everything was being torn apart, there was a song that arose in Edom. Tear it down. Tear it all the way down to the ground. In one of the Psalms, is you hear them singing this song. Tear Jerusalem down to its foundations. What happens after that? Israel comes back into the land. What's interesting is the Nabataeans, and earlier you saw one of those wealthy families was Naboth. His family at some point comes back and sacks all of Edom and takes all of them. And so there was a group of them that escaped. And if you were that group of Edomites, where would you escape to for cover? Israel. We're family. They come up and they settle in the south of Israel. And they change their name. They become Edomeans. Edomeans. Who was the most famous Edomean in the Bible, in the New Testament? Herod. Herod is an Edomite. Herod is an Edomean. Herod, who wanted to do what? Kill the promise. He sent, remember, killing all the babies in Bethlehem because he wanted to kill the promise. That spirit of the flesh always through. So what happened to them? In about 65, 66 AD, all of the Jews revolt against Rome. The Edomeans join with them. And they're wiped out when Jerusalem falls in AD 70. What do we take away from chapter 36? The struggle between God's people Israel and the people who weren't. Edom. People of the flesh. spiritual people with faith in God, and then you have the fleshly people with faith only in themselves. At the heart of the flesh, as we see from God's Old Testament illustration, think of this as the picture of what the New Testament is giving us in doctrine. This is the picture of what it looks like to live in the flesh, to live for yourself. These pictures show us their pride, their arrogance. They live for themselves. They live for the moment. They live with no thought of God. Esau traded God's blessings and his position and his inheritance for what? To satisfy the hunger at one meal. Next time you are facing a temptation that is going to be over in 5 minutes, what are you trading for that meal? You could care less about the privilege of being in God's blessing. Was it willing to trade it? Just know that God hates that heart attitude. They trust in their own power, their own wealth, their own status, their own fame. They'll do anything to get it. They'll do anything to make it bigger. They'll do anything to keep it. Remember what Paul told the Roman believers? Those who live for the flesh have set their minds on the things of the flesh. But those who live according to the Spirit set their minds on the things of the Spirit. For to set your minds on the flesh is death, but to set your mind on the Spirit is life and peace. Those in the flesh are hostile to God. Those in the flesh cannot please God. But you, Paul talking to those believers, me talking to you believers, you're not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if in fact the Spirit of God indwells you. And if the Spirit of God indwells you, this is what Paul says, the same Spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you. Stop and think for a moment when you are facing a fleshly pull and recognize it to be flesh. Is it something that's pushing me to do it right now? Is it something that's pushing me outside? Is it something that's taking me where I shouldn't go? And you start to understand that's the flesh side of me. Remember, the same Spirit who raised Jesus Christ from the dead to life dwells in you. Call on him. Greater is he that is in you, greater than he that is in the world. You'll be able to withstand it. And so the same Spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you. And he who raised Christ Jesus will give life to you. So you're left this morning the same way I left you last week. There's two groups. Last week I asked you, which group are you going to be gathered to? Today I'm going to ask you which group is going to win the battle. This battle, this struggle that's real. In the world, there are two people groups. Those with faith in God, who trust in his Son's death and resurrection, and are indwelled by his Spirit, who will rise together on that day to eternal life, to be forever together with him. And there's another people, those who trust in themselves, who put their faith in their own flesh, their own abilities, who live for today. The things of this world are the things that capture their minds. They're not willing to wait. They want it now. And then that day coming, they will be cast down and put away from him for eternity. That's the battle you're in. So who are you? Are you people of the Spirit? True Israel? Children of God? Children of faith? Or people of the flesh? You're Edom's kin, children of Adam. I will tell you, in the same way that the Lord called to Abraham, the Lord can call to you. And if you hear his voice calling to you, and you recognize it to be his, respond. He's listening to your heart. I don't need you to raise your hand this morning. I don't need you to walk down to the front this morning. If you hear his voice, he'll hear your heart. Tell him, I think it's you. I think it's real. Help me to figure this out. And the same Spirit that raised Jesus from the grave was at work inside. That's it. Chapter 36. Let's sing.